There was a problem with Justin's flight from New York City to San Jose, California. Just when the cabin doors were closing, three security persons came in and walked back to a kid dressed like a snowboarder in a middle seat a few rows behind Justin. "Excuse me, sir." The kid took his earphones off. "Sir, can you please come with us?" They were not friendly or its opposite, tense or its opposite. They waited for the kid to get up and walked him out. Then there was a delay as the ground crew opened the cargo doors, took out all the luggage, and heaped it on the tarmac in the middle of a July rain. One of the security personnel was still on the plane, searching the area where the kid had been sitting. After a few minutes, Justin twisted around and asked nervously, "What is it, a terrorist?" The security person, a man in his 50s with steel gray hair and a saggy gut, looked up. "Sir," he said, "please return to your seat." "I'm not out of my seat," Justin said. "I'm just asking you." "Please sit down, sir," said the security person loudly. Soon the whole plane was watching them. It was as if Justin had become dangerous, when all he wanted to know was what they suspected the kid of doing. What was wrong with wanting to know? He settled back in his seat and closed his eyes, as if the exchange had made him tired, which, in a way, it had. What was worse, by the time the ground crew got the rain-soaked bags back on the plane, they'd lost their takeoff slot. They lurched into the air 2 hours late and banked over a country almost entirely covered with cloud. All the way across the Midwest, Justin fumed about the incident. The disaster he had possibly avoided, being blown up in midair, hurtling into some monument, bothered him less than the humiliation of being rebuked for asking a simple question. Finally, mountains veered out of the cloud like brown trucks. The plane sank. In a moment, Justin was skimming over a lattice of blue-green lights strung out across the Black Bay, around the Black Bay. He folded his tray table, bit his lip, and felt his stomach rise as everything else went down. They were supposed to arrive in the afternoon. Now it was night. Justin wheeled his bag along the curb wearily, looking for the shuttle to his hotel. He came to a pretty Asian woman in a t-shirt. "Excuse me," he said, "do you know which bus is the Sheraton?" "We're waiting for it," the woman said. "We?" An older man in a rumpled suit, a cart of suitcases. "Where are you coming from?" Justin asked. "Guangzhou," said the woman. "Business trip?" The woman nodded. What else would bring anyone to San Jose? Although Justin had his own reasons for coming here tonight. He'd once been in love with a woman named Jillian who lived in San Francisco. His love never went anywhere. She lived with an architect named Andrew who watched over her jealously. But Justin hadn't been able to stop being in love with her. Eventually, he moved to New York and went on with his life. He thought he'd put Jillian out of his mind, but when his boss sent him to San Jose to make a presentation to a new client, he flew out 2 days early in the hope of seeing her again. "Me too," he said. The shuttle came and Justin helped the Asian couple to load their bags onto it. Their bags were incredibly heavy. Justin wondered what was in them. Commercial samples? Statuary? Anyway, he'd broken the ice. The woman told him that her name was Oria. The older man was her father, as Justin might have guessed. Oria spoke English with no accent whatsoever. She'd grown up in Mountain View and gone to college at Berkeley. She and her father had moved to China 10 years ago. She liked it okay, but she missed the Bay Area, her friends. Guangzhou was crowded and lonely. As she chatted, Justin felt himself unwinding. He told her the story of the police and the snowboarding kid. "Sorry." "That's so scary," said Oria. "A terrorist on your plane." "He didn't look like a terrorist," Justin said. "What do they look like?" asked Oria. "Good point." Still, Justin wanted to talk about what had happened, and Oria seemed like a sympathetic listener. He described the incident with the security person, his anger and shame. "That's a bummer for sure," Oria said. Her father looked at Justin but said nothing. The shuttle drove down a 6-lane street void of traffic, past businesses that offered indistinct services, hair, nails, maybe eyes and teeth, cars. Then they were at the hotel, and Justin realized it wasn't his hotel. This might be a Sheraton, but it certainly wasn't the Sheraton, or even one of the more important ones. Three white stories made a half-hearted L around a scrap of pool, dark for the night. Oria and her father descended from the van. Justin hesitated. He ought to say something to the driver, to be taken to his hotel, which, although he had never seen it, was surely bigger than this one, and more decent. On the other hand, there was Oria, struggling with a bag that probably weighed more than she did. It wasn't like one hotel was really different from another, Justin thought, and helped Oria with her luggage. He took down his own suitcase and followed her, his bag squeaking along behind him like an indicator, a sign to all who cared to read it that a human being was on the move. "Well," Oria said, turning to Justin when they entered the lobby, "maybe we'll see you tomorrow." Justin smiled and nodded. It seemed as if their conversation was over, but in fact they were going to the same place, the reception desk. To Justin's misfortune, there were two clerks on duty. He had to explain to the second clerk, a friendly woman named Vivian, that he did not have a reservation. "No problem," Vivian said, smiling. "How many nights will you be staying with us?" "3. King-sized bed okay?" "Yes," Justin said, a little embarrassed. Oria chose that moment to lean over and say, "Have a good night." Then she and her father took their room keys and wheeled their bags to the elevator. And Justin turned back to Vivian and arranged his mode of payment. Up in his room, Justin thought about calling Jillian. It was 10 o'clock on Saturday night. She'd be awake. She was a night owl. Once they'd sat on the balcony of her apartment, smoking cigarettes and talking about German philosophy until dawn. Jillian was one of those people who seemed to have shoehorned herself into a life that was a size too small for her. She ought to have been a bohemian, but in fact she lived in the marina with an architect, wore silk scarves, got up early to run by the water. He'd asked her why she did it that night on the balcony. This was before he'd given up on seducing her away from Andrew. "Don't you worry that you'll get tired of living a double life," he'd asked. "You don't understand," Jillian had said. "It's not a double life." She took a long drag on her cigarette. "It's all me, just like the inside and the outside of this house are all the same house." "I don't understand," Justin said. "Which is the inside and which is the outside?" Jillian stubbed out her cigarette and smiled at no one in particular. "Look," she said, "you can see the moon." That was the end of that part of their conversation. Justin wanted very badly to call Jillian now, but he hadn't told her he was coming, hadn't talked to her in almost a year. He didn't want to scare her away with his need. He went down to the hotel restaurant, thinking he might have a drink. Oria's father was there, sitting by himself at the bar, his fingers curled around a Coke, looking vacantly at a football game on TV. Poor guy's probably jet-lagged out of his mind, Justin thought. What's the time difference between here and China? Justin thought of joining him, but decided against it. Something about Oria's father put him off. His silence, maybe, or the way he sat straight up at his bar stool, not moving at all. Besides, Justin was more tired than he had thought. It was 9:30 in the morning when he woke up. He went downstairs, hoping for breakfast, and ran into Oria and her father in the lobby. Oria was wearing a white sundress and big black sunglasses pushed up on her head. Her father was dressed as he had been the night before, in a wrinkled green cotton sports coat, khaki slacks, a white button-down Oxford. Justin wondered if he'd slept at all. "We're on our way to the museum," Oria said. She looked at her father and hesitated. Then she said, "Would you like to come along?" "Sure," Justin said. "Why not?" He'd kept the day free, hoping he might spend all or part of it with Jillian, but it was too early to call her. His whole plan had been thrown off by the snowboarding terrorist kid. He certainly didn't want to spend the day alone at his strange, forlorn hotel. Justin followed Oria and her father outside. It was brilliant blue daytime. The sun seemed to be coming from everywhere in the sky, lighting the deserted street like a movie set. Oria pushed her sunglasses down over her eyes. The three of them stood there awkwardly at the curb, not speaking. Then Justin said to Oria's father, "So, you live in China?" It was an idiotic thing to say. The father didn't answer. Maybe he didn't speak English. Justin wished he hadn't accepted Oria's invitation. Probably she had only asked him to be polite. Now she was wondering what he was doing, tagging along. He was about to make an excuse. He'd forgotten something in his room. He had to make a call. When a cab pulled up and they all got in, Oria gave the driver an address, and almost at once they were on a freeway, rushing past other cars that were rushing past a landscape of muddy tans and greens, hills and sheds and towers built from metal struts, everything preternaturally distinct in the sunlight. Now, for the first time, Oria's father spoke. "How much do you know about the Rosicrucians?" Uh-oh, thought Justin. He knew a little about them from an occult section of the bookstore phase in junior high. A secret society founded in the Middle Ages, something to do with the Freemasons. Freemasons plus magic, maybe. Alchemy, eternal life, cowls, Da Vinci Code stuff. Was Oria's father recruiting Justin into a secret society? This seemed like an awfully haphazard way of going about it. "Nothing, really," he said. Oria's father explained that Rosicrucianism was a combined and perfected metaphysical system developed by philosophers over the ages. This is true, by the way. He made it sound like a new model of toothbrush. "It is the science of self-mastery," he said. You may ask, what exactly does self-mastery mean? It means learning how to chart your own course through life, how to find the means to make the right choices and decisions. It means seeing your present circumstances as unlimited opportunities for growth because you have the ability to change your situation. It means being able to take charge of your life and help those around you to achieve a happier and healthier existence. Did Oria's father think Justin was in need of self-mastery? Was this somehow about what he had been saying the night before, about what happened on the plane? And did Oria's father know that Justin had allowed himself to be driven to the wrong hotel? Achieving mastery of the self is the first step to attaining mastery of fate, Oria's father said. Oria looked embarrassed for both of them. Then the cab stopped and they got out opposite a high white stucco wall, interrupted by a gate in the Egyptian style. What was this place? It wasn't Egyptian. It was barely, in quotation marks, Egyptian. It looked like someone had taken some Egyptian scenes from Bible comics and rendered them haphazardly in concrete and white stucco. A replica sphinx crouched on a pediment. A replica obelisk climbed out of a blue California fountain, its dry basin littered with oblong dark leaves. Suddenly, Oria's father had his camera out, and he was taking pictures of everything and nodding to himself, like he'd been here before, not as a living person, but in a dream. He was nodding as if to confirm, yes, these were the things he had seen in his dream. He took hold of Oria's arm and stationed her next to a bronze bust of some bald man from the 1940s. He pulled her down a flight of steps and made her stand in a kind of basin. Justin, abandoned, looked around on his own. A big building attracted his attention. He read a notice that informed him that it was a lecture hall for Rosicrucian initiates. Everyone else, please keep out. But the gates were chained. No one was clamoring to get in. When they went inside the museum proper, it was even worse. The display cases were sparsely stocked with late-period Egyptian odds and ends, punctuated with crude dioramas and relief maps of the Nile Delta that lit up uselessly when you pushed a button. Oria's father spoke knowledgeably, just now gesturing at the exhibits, now pointing at himself, as though he were an ancient Egyptian, there to offer them a valuable first-hand perspective on the artifacts. They came to a mummified child, like a big bandaged hot dog with a head. First, the brains are drawn out through the nose with a hook, Oria's father said. Then an incision is made along the side with a sharp Ethiopian stone. It was creepy. Oria's father sounded like a recording played back through a human being's body, his voice hollow and somehow distant, not to mention his use of the present tense. An incision is made. After a while, Justin drifted away from them. He went down into a life-size replica of a tomb, then up again into a room where the civil life of the ancient Egyptians was on display. Why all this Egyptian stuff? Justin wondered. And where were the exhibits in which the secrets of the Rosicrucian order were revealed? Or was that the point? Was the museum intended not to educate its visitors, but to keep them in the dark? He imagined secret rooms behind the ones he saw, where Rosicrucians in black cowled robes watched his vain progress and chuckled to themselves. Eventually, he found himself in a cul-de-sac, where a scale model of a building was preserved in a plexiglass box, only model of its kind in the United States. Justin looked at it vacantly. White plaster, stepped pyramid, tiny stairs, tiny people in the courtyard for scale. Justin felt that way himself, as if he existed only for scale, to make it apparent to some outside observer just how big the world really was. He leaned against the wall, then sank to the floor. He rested his head on his arms and closed his eyes. After a while, he heard footsteps approaching, and Oria called his name. She sounded worried. "Over here," Justin said. He was touched that she should worry about him. To Justin's further surprise, Oria sat down beside him. "I came to apologize for my father," she said. "He gets really excited when he talks about this stuff." "No need to apologize," said Justin. "I'm just tagging along. You two should do your thing." "He's so boring," Oria said. "He thinks everyone is interested in exactly the same stuff as him. The Egyptians this, the Egyptians that. I mean, who cares?" "I was wondering," Justin said, "shouldn't there be something about the Rosicrucians?" Oria seemed not to hear him. "The thing is," she said, "he's had a really hard life." Suddenly, without Justin's having done anything to either to encourage or to prevent her, Oria was talking about her father's childhood. His parents had been poor farmers. He'd come to the U.S. on his own and won a scholarship to MIT. He'd invented a kind of computer switch and started a company, but then he got into trouble. "Trouble?" said Justin. "Yes," Oria said. "He was double-crossed by his business partners." Justin was going to say, "How dramatic," but just then Oria's father appeared. He looked displeased at finding them seated on the ground, but all he said was, "Come on, it's time for lunch." They went to an Italian restaurant across the street from the museum. The restaurant was practically empty, but it seemed to inspire a kind of awe in Oria's father. "Many important people have come here," he said. "Raymond Andrea himself has come here." "Who's Raymond Andrea?" Justin asked. It was the right question. For the first half of their meal, linguine with clams for Justin, spaghetti bolognese for Oria and her father, Oria's father talked about the life of the great Raymond Andrea, a British Rosicrucian, the author of many learned books, and also, it seemed, a combatant in the Second World War. "Can you imagine," Oria's father said, "when he was 40 years old, Raymond Andrea volunteered for the British Special Boat Service. He fought alongside men half his age. They traveled up and down the Aegean in special folding boats, strangling German sentries with their bare hands." This sounded like fable to Justin, but he was too polite to say anything. Oria's father was flushed. A dot of red sauce danced on the roof of his chin. "What's even more impressive is that his eyesight was very poor," Oria's father said, "not unlike my own." Oria smiled apologetically as if to say, "I'm sorry my father is boring you again." But Justin had no chance to be bored. Without transition, Oria's father said, "It was in the prison library that I discovered Raymond Andrea's great work, The Technique of the Disciple." "Prison?" Justin involuntarily gawked. "Yes," Oria's father said. "I committed the entire book to memory. It begins with these lines. A master said to his pupil, 'But you have to remember that you are at a hard school and dealing now with a world entirely different from your own.' When I read these words, I felt that I had at last encountered a mind capable of understanding my despair. What I had taken for the end of my life was in reality a school, and my work there was to learn." Oria's father had spent 6 years in prison, and he had studied the Rosicrucian literature with unimaginable attentiveness. You may ask me literally anything about the teachings, Oria's father said. I know them all by heart. It was a story straight out of the Count of Monte Cristo, Justin thought. Next, Oria's father would describe how he had dug his way out of prison with a spoon and the years he had spent plotting his revenge. He looked at Oria again. Where had she been while he was in prison? She was expressionless, picking at her green salad. Very interesting, said Justin. It is an enormous power, Oria's father said. He looked at his watch. We had better go, or we will be late for the planetarium show. He asked for the check, and Justin reached for his wallet. No need, said Oria's father. He put down a credit card without looking at the bill. Oria still hadn't looked up from her salad. I'll stop there.